So today's talk is given by Dr. Geisha Smith, Programme Manager for Transparency at the Local Government Association. Our talk is entitled Value of Geospatial Data in Local Services. Dr. Smith has extensive experience in working with GIS in the local government sector and has gained in-depth knowledge and expertise in the use of GI to deliver improved citizen services. Geisha holds a PhD in Digital Terrain Modelling from the University of Alberta, Canada, and started her professional career in Britain in 1993 as a lecturer in GIS at the University of Greenwich. And she later led the development and implementation of GIS in Medway Council, for which Medway won the AGI Local Government Best Practice Award in 2000. And I should say that today she will be talking about her current work, which includes much of the latest craze, open data, which we're all very pleased about. So open data and the applications of all these good practices to better serve the needs of public, citizen and everyone. But she's also been actively involved with the AGI since 1998 as a member of several committees, an AGI council member, and in 2004 as chair of the GI Strategy Action Group to develop a GI strategy for England. And she also founded and chaired the Local Government Special Interest Group there, and has worked with both local and central government to promote the use and sharing of GI within the government sector. Therefore, without further ado, Geisha.
Okay, thank you very much. It's really nice to speak in front of a university audience because I used to lecture, so it brings me back to it. I'm working more and more nowadays with public services, within public services, because the Local Government Association is actually an umbrella organisation for all local authorities in England. What we are doing is driving, first in the past they were sort of geographic information policy and applications. Now we are looking for a much wider data agenda, the open data, and we see more and more location data actually being subsumed into that whole agenda. So what I want to do today is take you a little bit on a journey, because I heard from Owen that I want to focus to see where GI can be applied in local services and what the value is. But I want to take it a little bit wider and a little bit further. What was there originally, and going back to a study which we carried out in 2010-11, and moving on of policy drivers which are happening at home in the public sector around Inspire, the Inspire Youth, the Inspire Initiative, and open data, because that's really where a lot of initiatives and energy in the public sector and beyond is going. So it's a little bit through the path, and at the end, let's talk anything I haven't covered. You can ask me any questions. If I have the knowledge, I'll let you know. Otherwise, maybe someone in the room can answer the question. So I see it's quite interactive. So, value of geospatial data and local services. I looked at it again. People tried a few years ago to put a value on geospatial data and services. And I, in preparation, what I always do before I give a talk, I look up what some of the latest magazines, and it happened to be that in GeoProfessional there was actually an article about what is the economic impact of geoservices, and Oxera, a lead company which is looking at economic analysis, pointed out that the value of geospatial services around the world is 0.2% of the GDP. That's the sector you're working in. Just to put it a little bit into perspective, what is happening globally, what I'm doing here today is looking very narrowly at what is happening at the local services sector, and in particular some experiences which we have more from England, but I try to make some reference to Scotland, and I spoke to Ian Mackay earlier on, and we found that a lot of the policies are quite similar between what is happening in England, what is happening in Scotland. They have obviously their local emphasis, and sometimes they're slightly different things. So I hope you can still follow what I'm talking about and can make associations. What is happening in Scotland? So where are we sitting with the whole agenda in the local public services and local government at the moment, and where is geospatial data coming in and is helping actually and adds value to what's going on? So when we look at it, I looked at the figures for Scotland. There are 32 local authorities in Scotland which are spending which are serving 5.1 million people
with services very much locally. In order to provide the services, they need to have a lot of local knowledge. What's happening there? Where are the needs of people? Where are we providing services? Where are the demographics? Where do we put the infrastructure? And this morning when I came in from the airport, I heard the story, the ongoing story about the Edinburgh tram, and I wonder if people have very good local geospatial knowledge, tunnels and all sorts of things, maybe there could have been a better decision making. So geospatial data and where something is and where something is happening is always very much at the forefront in local decision making. And so geospatial information carries it through from the decision making, what is needed, where the people who need something, to at the end where decision is actually taking, and then implementing the services. And I think for you, it is the other way around. You have your smartphone, you walk around with your smartphone, and you for yourself want to know where your nearest services are, where your nearest hub is, where your nearest leisure centre is. So that's where the location element comes in. It's really, where are we? What do we need at a certain place? So that comes to the next thing, which is place matters. Because of the local services which are provided, there's very much a localism agenda or a community-led agenda, community-led regeneration. What's happening locally? How can we influence decision-making? Then obviously we feel the spending cuts everywhere. I think in the South we feel them more than here in Scotland. Local government had a cut in grant funding of 43%. So services are just disappearing. It's not only about efficiencies, it's about making do, sharing services, anything about it. So there's a great drive to see how we can improve our productivity, and knowing about where something is provided, or sharing services around geospatial data, or sharing data, or anything like that, adds to saving money. So that's something which we are looking at as well. The other big driver is the information economy, which is around us everywhere because everybody talks about data. Big data, use of data, everything is streamed into mobile applications or online applications, and what you need for it is good and valuable data. So government is very much looking at data and information as a potential for growth, for economic growth that it can drive the economic growth. And there are several policies around that. And some of them are actually priority in Scotland, and some are coming in. And civil society is getting a much stronger voice and a hand through community-led activities. And also because there is a shift from the public sector doing everything for the citizen to enabling the citizen doing it themselves. And for that to do, you need to have, again, good data. Data is underpinning all of that shift which we are seeing. Another driver is our demographic shift, the aging population. What are we going to do to meet the needs and demands of that aging population? Growing health and care needs, how can we meet with them? How can we provide the best services? And underpinning that again is the question of place. Where are the needs, where people with similar needs abounded, where the care homes do we serve? All these questions which people face at the management level are getting underpinned from locational data. And then environmental change, there's a discussion this week again going on, is it man-made or is it not man-made? So I think the argument is from our point of view more, or from I believe more, that environmental change coming from human influences. So we have to be more energy conscious. How can we drive that? How can we drive low carbon economy, energy efficiencies, and so on. So those are all, it's sort of a basket of challenges which are coming in. And everywhere, location information, so geospatial information, drives that. I already talked about that we need to self-regulation and assessment, it is when you work in a local authority, you want to know how good your services are in comparison to a neighbouring authority. So you need standards in order to compare what you're doing with a neighbouring authority. And maybe you, as a citizen who are voting and paying tax, want to know as well, how good is your local council doing in comparison to the council where you maybe live at home? How well is Edinburgh doing when you're living as a student? Those are questions. We're working more and more in partnerships in order to share, save money, so there's more a need for shared services. So again, that impacts on the data side, because one council might hold the data in one format, another council might hold it in a different format. Heralds, which are now working much more closely with local authorities, might hold data in a different format. How do you bring that together? How do we use the same semantics, same meaning of different data categories? How do we categorize and standardize our data that they can be used in the same similar way? In order for that to work across shared services, you need standards. We talked about the self-service and the channels shift. You don't want to call or go to a council office, you want to do everything online, basically. And that's what the councils are serving more and more. There's obviously also and then there is a big drive in local government to improve the services and to be more innovative, because we have to totally rethink how services are being provided, because we cannot do it the old-fashioned way, that there's one government or one department who has their specific processes of doing things. We need to move much more across. So that's how customer services sector came into being. How do they deal with customer inquiries? Shared. So if the road is stuck up, you don't want to only dig up the road for new wires or something. You want to dig it up once. So you try to coordinate different requests which are coming. So in 2010, the Local Government Association looked at the value of geographic information and issued a study with Consulting Aware to look into where the value of geographic information sits. And out of that came the main value comes through the improving services in emergency planning, for example, with linking flood risk assessment to preventative measures instead of waiting with the fallout of any flooding. Cutting carbon emissions, for example, the more drive to solar panels, where's the best way of putting carbon preventative measures into place in the housing market, where can we improve housing efficiencies and so on. Then around sustainable environment management, protecting the environment because there's more and more pressure on it, because there are more and more people living on the globe. There's tremendous population pressure also in the UK. So where do we put the people, and how do we preserve the environment and the local which is there? And much more. So this is just giving you a little bit sort of a background. And what I do now is I take you through a few examples which we used in the study by Consulting Aware to look at if geographic spatial information was used, where would it lead to? So the first one is about energy efficiency. So the Nottingham City Council looked at a program for the social housing stock to put in solar panels to be more energy efficient. And they did an assessment of which houses would be most suitable, where would they be located so that they had south-facing panels, that enough panels could be put on them. And as a result of it, they actually reduced their carbon footprint quite a lot on those buildings. That was one of the key policies. Others are about transport, reducing carbon emission by reducing congestion, signposting roadworks, things like that, so people can better route when they're travelling. And that's partly being taken on by SatNavs now as well, that you'll automatically be rerouted if there are roadworks happening. Because that information is streamed out into those types. that's again a geographic and locational element. There have been lots of studies of optimizing routes of transport routing for picking up children for school with special needs, transporting elderly people to daycare centers and so on. In the past, there were all sorts of different contractors and they had really inefficient routes, how they picked up people. So a lot of savings were made through route optimization methodologies of saving money. Again, it's a classic GIS application. Find the most efficient route to take people from one place to where they want to go. Other examples on this also apply very much to waste management, improving waste management by finding where waste would be would need to be picked up, what type of waste, is green waste, is normal waste, is special waste, and then designing the routes around it. And that led to substantial efficiency savings in local authorities. As you can see there, for example, changing the working routine from 5 days to 4 days and making savings that way, or having fewer baby pills. So, for example, London Borough of Harrow saved over 10 years 3.1 million more efficient the way they're planning the waste prevention. Use of location information in crime analysis. I mean, there's quite sophisticated crime analysis now carried on using location information. What they're doing is that they are analysing the patterns of crime, and if there's certain patterns related to factors, or looking also at individual people who are committing crimes, and that way targeting where they might be hitting the next crime, the next crime, the next crime. So, for example, they found out that people who are committing crime often commit the crime in certain areas, either close to home, or they have a special area which they know they can. So people are released, and then from prison there's a spurt of crime happening again. They look into those areas where they committed those crimes before and can do a relationship about that. And that's all based on spatial data as well. So there are lots of examples from South Yorkshire Police who used extensively geospatial data of mapping out where crime is happening at what time and then targeting their police resources based on that analysis. And they made savings per hour of around £350,000. Another one, addressing. Having a good register of all properties is at the core of a lot of local services, because that links to where people live, inquiries are coming in, services that are given. So if you go to school, you have a new address where you're coming from. If you need care, you have your home address and where you need your services and so on and so on. In the past, in local authorities, they had address guarantees for all of these different services, and they were not linked up. What they do now is they have a central gazetteer, and they're linking up all that information. So if you make an inquiry or there is an inquiry, they know that also immediately, because the address is georeferenced, where the person lives is connected to where they have their needs. And that way they can do all sorts of analysis and linking data to, for example, there might be elderly people who are benefit claimants, they live in energy inefficient homes, they need care support, there's special health issues. So they, because that address is the referencing, the common link between all of these different data sets, people can analyze and create profiles of people where they're living. So that's quite important, for example, if there's an emergency happening, there were floods happening, they could look in their databases, find out the area of flooding, could identify where there were particular people with special needs, so they could be rescued first, because they have these special needs. So again, geography becomes one of these common reference points where data can relate and come huge savings to be made by using a common reference data set through the embassy and then sharing it with all sorts of different service lines. It's believed for England that there were savings between 15 to 24 million pounds made by using this common reference data. Other examples I already mentioned is doing things online. For example, if you have incidences which you want to report or flight things like that, you nowadays can do that all online. And you, in most instances, you can also do that through your mobile phone. There have been several apps developed, I don't know which ones are available in Scotland, but down south it's called LAF, Netaway or LAF, whatever you type it in, record your incidents. And that goes straight back into the report that is in the council of UNESCO, also the link to the contractor. So if that is also geo-reference, they can immediately set their operational services out in order to fix things. In the past, that was much more difficult to do because there was such poor referencing of geographic locations. Nowadays, you can actually walk, say, phone directly to the location, send your message, they know where you have been. It's geographically referenced, then they send it somewhere. And again, geography is key. Often we don't see it, but it's hidden, it's sitting behind it. Another one which is quite interesting is the insight work. Customer insight, understanding more the needs of people and how then campaigns, health preventative campaigns, and so on can be targeted very specifically. What is used is a lot of different socioeconomic data to be analyzed, and there are socioeconomic groups created for different output areas around the census. And they're taking on board information about ethnicity, income, deprivation, needs. There are all sorts of different factors which are pulled together, and then different areas, output areas, get certain codes related to it. And that can be then combined with information which a council holds, or a health organization holds, or whatever. So for example, if a council has been identified with very high teenage pregnancy rates, they want to know where exactly in the council is the highest likelihood of those teenage pregnancy rates, because it would be too expensive to do a campaign across the whole area. So what they do is they use quite often those ethnicity parameters, census data, and so on, to first of all identify those areas where there's the highest group of teenage girls in particular, and then also map out where they have found in the past the highest pregnancy rates, and see if there's a correlation, and find them areas which they might particularly target with campaigns and preventative measures and so on. And that's also used for smoke cessation campaigns, all sorts of different ways of doing that. And a council which has best made use of geospatial data, demographic data, socioeconomic data, Swindon. They believe that they tell a whole story about the people they have in the authority, where they are, what they do, what their patterns is, and relate that to very detailed statistical information. That way they know when they go out for a campaign or they want to bid for money, they know exactly what their needs are. And they can explain it, they have the evidence for it. On the basis of that evidence, Swindon has been very, very successful to get several million grant funding around social care and health and so on, because it had very good data. And the geographic information manager works directly to the lead business and policy unit. So always think a little bit wider than just geospatial data. Think about where can you link location with other information, and becomes a very, very powerful information source within an organization. So this is what you see here. You can then visualize it. And one of the other things about where the power and the value of geographic information comes in is the ability to visualize. Because people, they're not interested in numbers. They want to see images which are understandable. So it's the patterns, trend, and anomalies in a spatial sense which can be identified very quickly and easily, and then the services can be targeted accordingly. And that's where the savings and efficiency can come. That's where the value of geospatial information comes. The other one is integrating data and services to bring all different data sets together into the data storage, but then making common references around them. Quite often, the geography database or the address database is the common reference for things that being linked with the linkages. So this is an example from the West Midland Fire Service, because fire departments do not only are being called out when a fire happens, they do actually also a lot of fire preventative service, risk service of buildings and so on. So with all the different information they have, they can do quite detailed risk analysis and prevent more fires, which is a lot cheaper than actually having to fight them all the time. So the benefit, the case studies showed a lot of different benefits, which I explained throughout. So the channel shift to online is a big one, improved efficiencies, better decision making, reduced data duplication, because the data is shared, brought together, commonly referenced. Frontline workers and citizens have much more power because they have access to the data. Helping to identify social deprivation and their needs are. And engaging more citizens because the data are now being put out much more. So you know what's happening in your local area. So as I said, there was a study done into the actual value, monitoring value, of services to local government. And the study by Consulting Ware concluded that there were savings of £230 million over 5 years from the local government alone using geospatial data. And then there was an analysis done of what the benefit was to the gross domestic product, and it was believed that that was 320 million higher over 5 years than would have been without the use of geospatial data in local authorities. Now, that study was done at the cusp when we had the austerity measures, so we don't have any more figures. I don't know if it had really materialized that higher GDP. But I think there's still a big value associated with it. Recently they did a study on the use of online survey open data, and they concluded that there is a benefit to the UK opening up the data of £13 to £24 million. So that was sort of the study then and there. I'm just giving you a little bit of flavour of what happened, the use of geospatial data in local authorities. What I want to do now is take you a little bit further about big policy drivers which are happening at the moment, and where location data are quite central and quite heavily used. And it's just really a very brief overview, which I want to demonstrate a little bit with data, again, just giving you examples about where location data plays a role. So there was a location strategy that's now quite old, and we are waiting for a new one. But I don't know if it ever happens. So at the moment it sits there, it's still being referenced because it has some good key points about data efficiency, signposting what data you have, and so on. Then there are public sector mapping agreement and the One Scotland agreement, which basically is an agreement with the Ordnance Survey to make their data available to the public sector. So you can share data and use data as much as you want, wherever you want. The problem is that that agreement doesn't extend out there to the private sector. Quite often you work hand in hand, private and public, and then you still have the difficulty to figure out, can I share the data or can I not share the data? Can I make it available or can I not? And you will see later on in your professional career, if you were It's a European regulation which came out to facilitate the access and sharing of geospatial data related to the environment. And that was really designed because it was identified that there were huge environmental problems around Europe. The environment doesn't stop at the boundary, so if you have air quality issues or anything else, it doesn't stop at the boundary. So what they wanted to do is harmonize the data across Europe related to the environment so that good environmental assessments could be made. And it then extended out into other data sets as well. So it is really a framework, a technical framework for and standards for publishing data, for metadata around geospatial data, and for data specifications to define in what format data should be published, the structure of data and so on. And it's quite innovative. Was quite innovative at the time because it's the first time really that standards are regulated. We didn't see that before. And it will be implemented by 2020, so we are just in the midst of it all. So it would be quite useful, possibly you might pick up more about Inspire if you haven't heard about it. Yeah. And then there is the transparency of open data, the whole drive of making data open to hold the government to account. That was the first thing why the open agenda really started. But now it has been picked up by government to be taken to the next stage. Because they realized by opening up this data, there are organizations which actually do something with the data, analyzing them, visualizing it, and so on. So it's the big data question. If you put all of this data together, you can suddenly see certain patterns of what is happening where. For example, they looked at prescription services for certain medicines to look at were the health strategic health service actually efficient in prescribing certain medicines. So there are all sorts of ways how things can be done. So this is now a big drive which is coming up, not only in the UK, but it's a global movement, and the government is lead on the Open Government Partnership, just recently published a charter about data, open data, which has now been signed by 68 countries, committing to opening up data in various different areas. So as I mentioned, Inspire regulation, I will show you a few slides on what is happening actually around Inspire, again with the emphasis on local services, because that's what I said I will talk about today. So, there are about 34 data themes defined under Inspire. They are the core data like transport and addresses and administrative boundaries. Then there are general environmental data like geology, terrain data, and so on. And then there are specific data around regulation zones, hazard zones, government services, land use, anything related to planning, environmental policies. I mean, it depends a little bit on the interpretation that you actually put on that. The key thing is that you have to provide a catalogue of what data you have inside the system. So nowadays, you can go on the catalogue and find what is there. When we did environmental impact assessments first at Network many, many years ago, it took us months and months and months just to identify the data. Now you just go to data and go, that the government requires. Then you can use the data because the data is not only made available, it's made available as a service which you can stream directly in your application. So what it means for you is that if you're working with GIS, you don't have to download the data anymore, put it on a server, manage it and maintain it. No, you just click a URL and you stream the server data as a service directly. So it makes it much more efficient. I talked about the harmonization of data compliant with standards earlier on, and then there's some other bits and pieces about harmonizing and licensing around it as well. So what the UK has done is they have created a metadata catalogue for any public sector information. It doesn't even have to be open, it's a catalogue of any data that exists currently there are 40,000 data sets on there, signposted on there. There's very little from local authorities yet. So this is just public sector across the UK. And then you can search for data and so on and so on. There's a particular area around location information, and that is partly because of Inspire, that it requires data sets to be published on data.gov.uk. So if you look for any geospatial data, go there as a first instance. And it's not only that you need to publish your data, you also need to publish if you have a service provider, like a view service where you can stream the data into your application. So you can be really lazy in the future. Just go there, and you work very quickly, just stream the stuff into your application producer, put it back, and you're done. And that's really where the efficiencies are coming from. We're not quite there yet. So very few local authorities are publishing the data there yet. I want to give you an example of one of the leading authorities in the country, Borough of Clonfernas, a little district council near the Lake District in Northern England. And what they have done, they have implemented it all because they sit lots to do it in this time, and you did a brilliant application using open source from GeoServer to create a web service around all the planning data which they hold with the Borough County Council. So what, Borough District Council. So what you can do is you can go in and search for any data set. In this instance, I look for conservation areas, and then you can look at the details. Search wise. And then there is a map search functionality where you can actually also take a first view what data sets, how does the data set look at. Again, these are the conservation areas which Borough has mapped out. But not only that, you can then go to the Inspire portal in Europe, and the metadata which sits on the UK portal are actually streamed through to the portal in Europe, and that's the whole idea of Inspire. That you can look now at environmental data across Europe, because they're all streamed in the same way to certain standards. So they are collected here in the UK through data.gov.uk, and then they're streamed up to this European portal. So it's all the same data, it all sits at Borough County Council, Borough Council. They're publishing it, and then it gets linkages. And this is where they have their own map mapping service, where they're displayed in their own environment. It suddenly looks different, but it's the same data which you see anywhere else in all the other applications. Now, Borough used open source software, and they made savings because they were totally open source and managed their data much more in a central place, £26,000, just to go back to the value. But there are many more benefits to just going in and streaming the data directly through for external organizations. So that's what I said. Good data management internally is a benefit, but the real benefits are probably felt elsewhere. And that is demonstrated in this diagram. We found with a lot of this work which is going on around Inspire or anything of open data and standardizing, that the costs are actually highest at the local level. Because local authorities or small organizations have to invest quite a lot into an infrastructure to put this data out and put it into that standard initially. The beneficiaries are really global organizations, more at a national level or at an EU level, because they can now go in and stream the data directly through. What it was in the past was, or what's still happening, is that I spoke to Shona from the Scottish Government earlier on. She's collecting data from 32 local authorities. Someone sits there, gets the data through, gets the data request, collates it out, and so on. The idea is that the data is actually produced here in a standardized level, streamed out standardized. She can just sit on her desk and just say, I take this and this and this service, bring it all together, boom, I have a data set for Scotland. But we're not there yet. who's paying for them. So that's what we are struggling, and that's why I spent my morning discussing it. So, just to show you this whole issue around there are solutions for it, but where do the benefits sit? Where do the costs sit? Sort of this reverse of this upside down. How do we manage the cost transfer? So that was inspired. Just a few minutes. I don't know how much time I've
got. A wee bit. Yeah.
Okay. I didn't ask anyone if they have questions. I take them on at the end. What does everyone have? Okay. Let's carry on then on the journey. This is now the next big area I'm working in at the moment, which is about open data, and it's really. What is the emphasis now? Where are we going now? And it's really much, everything is on the mobile application. A lot of location-based services. It might not be necessarily a map, but a lot of location underpins what we are doing. So the idea is, in the future, we walk down the street, and we pass by a building, and automatically we get information streamed in about the building, what services are available. So you wouldn't even know, you wouldn't even touch a map. Or you might have a plug in the ear and it tells you exactly where to go, what to do, what is around you. So that's a whole idea of the smart environment that everything will be brought to you automatically through bringing data intelligence together. But what you need is that data become open so they can be used and exchanged. And we need the standards and the interoperability which inspire brains for geospatial data. We don't have that for other data. There are all sorts of other technical drivers which are also happening in the background. Broadband extension, so that you can actually use those services wherever you go, even in the Highlands. The digital transformation that services are all provided digitally, online, data as a service, as I explained, through Inspire. There's something called the G Cloud, which is the government cloud, that services are put on the cloud instead of holding it in local storage facilities. It's being put up globally where you can pick it up. With the mobile services, the smartphone, shared services, I talked about that earlier on, standards of Inspire, and then open data and big data. Big data is about the analytics. How do you analyze this huge amount of data which is now becoming on the screen? So, first of all, let's talk about standards of open data. Tim Berners-Lee, the founder of the internet, is proposing a 5-star model, where the lowest level is just to make your data open, the next one to make it machine readable. That means don't put it just out as a PDF, but put it out in sort of a little bit of smart way. Then use open standards at the next level so that it can be read by any software. For example, if you use an Excel format, that can be read by Microsoft. If you put it out in a CSV file, then it can be read by lots of applications. Make your data linkable, that's the 4-star, that means that you have reference to common reference. So, for example, you need property reference addresses. And then the top of it is make it link data to put it in an environment where it can be totally linked up. And then we talk about the web, the linked web, the semantic of things, where things, objects, can be linked. So the linked data environment. So that's the whole idea about it, and the model of the standards which sits behind it. There's been for quite a while, quite a lot of work going on in the local government sector, which is hidden away. Not many people actually outside of local government knows about it. But it's called the ESD standards, the Efficient Service Delivery Toolkit. And what they did for local government is looked at relationships within local government of what services are provided, are they linked to certain regulations and powers, are they linked to needs, and so on. And they have metrics. They have a very standardized corpus. So if you talk about certain visually impaired, there would be a very specific call for them. So everybody knows that they're talking about the same things. And that helps them to link data in this big world of linked data. So they have developed taxonomies and code lists for over 10 years and tried to keep it up to date so that local government can talk to each other about different services. So it's in parallel almost to Inspire and code lists which exist in there as well for certain things and so on. And that's quite important to understand why standards are much more promoted now in the data world. It helps with that linkage. As I said before, the drivers for open data at the moment is improvements, engaging citizens, but one of the big ones is at the moment around economic growth, improvements, and innovation. So I'm going a little bit quicker because I want to cut out a few bits just to show where open data sits. One of the biggest movements of open data is the OpenStreetMap. You've probably seen it. Otherwise, go there, use it. It's fantastic. It's a worldwide movement of creating crowdsourced open data for streets. But it's not only for streets, they're putting all sorts of other data sets in there now as well. So they're almost in competition now with the online survey around street data. You see more and more public sector organizations using OpenStreetMap because it's such good background mapping. It's licensed for you. You can use it wherever you want in any application you put. And this is now a map which puts on cycling routes, for example. Other examples of open data becoming available, and it's so rapid and so quickly how data are being used now by the media. There's something called the data journalism, where people pick up data, journalists pick up data and make use of it. That was particularly exemplified during the riots, or the riots last 2 years ago, where journalists picked up data which were published and immediately mapped it out to show where the centers of the riots happened and how they're possibly linked to deprived areas. Other examples, again, from Litchfield, who looked at food safety, because the local authorities have to do food safety inspections of restaurants and everything else. So they published their data on data.gov.uk, and normally you would have a link with all your restaurants' addresses. So they put that out in the document, but they also put a location tag to it. And then it was an app developed to link the food inspection with restaurants. So you can use the app if you want to go out in the evening, not only look up where your nearest restaurant is, how good it is, you can also look at the food inspection, and then it has a closure inspection about the kitchen, you might want to go to it. So that's another example of how open data is. Another one from Surrey, he's about planning applications which are now open, so you can look up where planning is happening, but they use it more and more open data in consultations. So they have a new consultation, and people can put in their comments, it's immediately geo-referenced, so you know where people come from. So again, it's about this community-led initiative that you can actually see, do people really come from your community who are voicing their opinion on things. And it's immediately streamed live, you can look up what other people comment, and that's also streamed into the planning department, so they see all the comments as well. Another geographic application, it's about numbers and numbers, and this looks at child obesity. They put up information about child obesity, linked to all sorts of other information, and what they put here in child obesity linked to takeaways. Is it happening more in areas where there's a concentration of takeaways? And that's public, that's open. Anybody can go in there and play this debate and do their analysis on themselves. It is geographic. Data share is open data source which makes available all spending data, all sorts of data, in Redbridge, London Borough of Redbridge. But what they have done is they mapped out all their suppliers to see, do they actually use local businesses or do their suppliers come from all over the UK? And it was astonishing to see the widespread of where suppliers are coming from. Another application of geospatial and anything that we call them. On a sandbox approach of seeing how they can use open data. And what they created is a little app for disabled people to look at where their streets, they map basically the steepness of streets and the condition of pavements to demonstrate to disabled users if a street was usable or not usable. So it's a mobility index app. So that's again a community-led initiative for people in wheelchairs. Asset mapping, there's a big drive demonstrating where public assets are, where public owns land. Again, it has to do with community-driven engagement. So if people want to start a children's afternoon club and they don't know where to locate it, they can look at it and see maybe there's a public building. But it also helps to draw the public sector together because beforehand, people didn't know what local authorities own, health own, self-government own, and now they're all working together because they can suddenly see what the other side of government is owning, maybe to co-locate services. Public rights of way, that's a little app which has been developed for Hampshire. They're putting up all their public rights of way, so if you want to go hiking, we can. You can just go side down with the app and you have all the public rights of way in your mobile phone. And this is the London bike app that was one of the early apps about if you're a bike in London and want to know where your docking stations are for using the Barclays bike in London, you can put in your location, find out where the nearest docking station is, if it is full or not. Because if you're cycling around, rent a bike, go from one place to another, you want to know where to do it. So, and this is one from Scotland. I put one in from Scotland. That's an application which is created by Swirl. They're doing all sorts of stuff with open data. It's a company which does all sorts of stuff with open data. And they created a little app about smart journeys combining weather data with home works data. So if you want to travel somewhere, look up what the conditions where you are. Again, location data. And finally, Glasgow Future Cities. Glasgow got quite a lot of money for their Future Cities program, where they're looking at ways how data can be brought together more intelligently so that the city and the city environment can work more efficiently. So that would be of managing transport automatically. So, for example, our buses are working, where the public transport is going, and so on. And they do that under four themes: health, energy, travel, and public safety. And maps play an absolute key part of it. It underpins a lot of the data. That's where the linkages are coming in. And they have created a dashboard around it. Should have put the link in. open.glasgow.gov.uk. If you go on there, there's stuff now on the website. So I just wanted to throw in a little example here. And it's this whole movement about smart cities, bringing data together to identify more the environment, where things should be built, are they energy efficient, if air quality levels are going very, very high or dangerous high, then there's automatic warning systems out there, and so on and so on. So it's managing the city environment intelligently, automatically, so that it can be managed more efficiently. And there are obviously all sorts of data sets sitting behind it which are combined together. So, where are we now? At the moment, we had, or still have, supply-oriented data provision. So data are supplied what the supplier says, but we are switching over to something which is more demanding. Systems and organizations help the data centrally. What we see more and more that it is actually going out to cloud platforms, that the data set out there can be shared across. In the past, we had local standards. So someone set a standard in their organization. was not looking how someone else structured the data. So we see much more open standards which are being used, and common linking, common referencing to put the data out in the web that they actually can be compiled. And increasingly, the data is being used by civil society and by businesses, which are actually coming out of the public domain. In the past, it was all held in the public sector, and a lot of it was anonymized there, or in the private sector. There's much more interaction now going on with the different data sets. What makes it very difficult is to see how this all can be monetized. What's the value of open data? Because if you put data out, you don't know where it is being used and where the benefits are being created. And what people are arguing at the moment is, just use the data, just have fun with it, just see what you can explore and do with it. And then see where the benefits are coming up, because we have this whole transition phase that algorithms are going. And I think it's part of you that you're sitting at the university, you can explore and play with the data. You will probably see much more of the new world emerging after all of this. So this is the linked data world. That's very, very early slide. When it started out, it was linking up to the data sets through common referencing. But we were really looking at what is the innovation coming out of this whole data linked data world. So that used to be, we had a pile of data that didn't know what to do with it. But now it's getting more and more linked up if common standards are being used and there's much more understanding. So they can be much more easier analyzed and linked, for example, to different areas because they all use the same common referencing. They're used on mobile phone and smart applications, used in smart cities. Government is predicting quite a bit of growth coming out of open data. We're living much more in a connected world, but also we are connecting more and working much more collaboratively together. So that's possibly what is happening when you go to these hackathons and these events where people now come together and explore what they can do with the data. What can they do with all of this open data which suddenly comes together? One of the big drivers that people understood very, very quickly at the beginning was that location and the reference where something is located is a key point. Is a key data source and a key reference. And that's why geographic and location data is such a great reference.
So a question, I'm right in there.
Rather than a question, Yesha, an advert.
Yeah.
And that is, there is a Scottish spatial data infrastructure which data is copied from there to data.gov.uk and then on to Europe.
Yes.
So we have a Scottish spatial
data. But do you have a call for that?
Yes.
What is the reference of it? If
I can't remember it off the top of my head, I'll look it up.
Okay.
Karen.
Yeah, there were a whole raft of questions that kept coming up during the presentation, but I think they were encapsulated by your second or third last picture there, which was all about moving from the supply side in terms of data to the demand driven and so on. And I guess my question is, what actually is the public sector doing to define what exactly the demand actually is? So who the hell actually wants any of this stuff in terms of open data? In terms of me as a citizen, me as somebody working for the private sector, or them working for the academic sector?
Yeah. I mean, I can answer that at the moment only for England, because I don't know quite what the structures are here in Scotland. But there's an open data user group in England, where they bring people, particularly from business, academia, and so on together, as a voice for outside of the public sector to identify what data are needed. TAS data has been released. So there's a whole range of data sets. I'm not online, but otherwise I could show you that. So that's one way when it's coming. I'm sitting on the Open Data User Group, so we are putting business cases forward to government, which is research where we try to take the economic argument as well as what are the benefits socially and so on. Where we have little interaction is with the individual citizens, or we have a community group representation on that board as well as the local public data power. They're quite proactive actually saying what they need. For example, they want to have more data out about the planning, for neighborhood planning, to make decisions about what should be built within a local community. There has been huge requests for putting planning data out in a whole.
I was just wondering how you think you could engage more in the future with the academic community, because that's one thing you said that we could play with the data, but do you see particular value in the academic community contributing back in and maybe saving money for them?
Yes, there are several different initiatives. It's ESRC working from here, and it's ESRC extending out there as well. Okay. ESRC has just, I don't know the figure. They have been given money to create data centers. And it is particularly working with the academic sector to create these data centers to get data out of local government and to provide an area where the data can be analyzed and researched to the benefit, for example, of improving public services. So and that's a particular call to the academic sector. I also know that there are developments of creating these research environments, sandbox environments, where data are being put secure and certain people who are vetted also within the research sector will have access to the data and can do more detailed analysis. And that has to do, for example, with data about education, because data about pupils cannot be released, but there are certain provisions made in a research environment that maybe for specific projects there's access being given to the academic sector to analyze and use the data. If you want more, I can send you the link from ESRC. They're doing quite a lot of work.
I was possibly meaning more on the, we've got more and more data. Part of the problem is that we're very consuming data and the conventional methods used to analyze it don't really scale. So today there was a conference in CASA, and last year we had a talk from one of those chaps. And they were looking at how you can analyse big data.
Yeah.
And maybe the academic sector could invest some time developing systems that then councils could use to actually manipulate massive amounts of data. So things like tap in, tap out some oyster cards, billions of records and transactions that we could hope to analyse in a desktop package. Just taking that from one researcher to massive data.
I think that's the idea about the data centers. But that's the ESRC funding going to the data centers to analyze it. There's also a lot of drives for big data. I need to look it up. If you want to have some references, I can send them around.
One at the back, and maybe one last one after that.
It's a question on the ethics of the crime data you're showing with the, I think it was Yorkshire Police, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, and how they were looking at crime hotspots,
yes,
and then seeing if these hotspots flare up when certain individuals are released. Is that data actually looking at specific crimes committed by that individual? It just seemed like it seemed like it was eroding almost like the innocent before proven guilty sort of idea.
I mean, that data is, first of all, not open.
Okay.
That is not open. It's within a police unit.
Well, even if it's within a police, you know, you see how it saves money, but it almost be like they have a list of which people have been freed recently and then crime in this area, so they can just go and pick up those people. But it seemed like it just seemed like it was.
What they're doing, they're analyzing the hotspots.
Yeah.
They have other information. There's more. are certain very clearly defined boundaries and limitations.
Okay.
So if there is a crime hotspot spotted and the patterns are absolutely identical to some other patterns they had before, then they can make a request for the data to see if it matches the same thing on the basis of that. But I don't know all the details about it because I didn't do the study, so please put Ron on that.
Shall we take that final question then, and then we've got to go for
My question is kind of ties in with Kevin and Annie's. How many examples have you seen of this open data being used by private companies to create valuable information? And so it becomes an economic boost where it would also encourage private participation in open data. A lot of the examples you showed are very good for, say, like the hills are evil.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it's a very good service, but no one would ever pay for that information. Do you have any examples of where this open data should be used?
I can refer you to the study which looked at that, but I haven't really researched it further for this topic because I was looking at a public data set. But when the Shakespeare Review came out, which looked at the which assessed the use of public sector information, so anything that is released, Deloitte did a very detailed market study on the value and use of open data. And there are some figures in there. Again, I can provide the link to it. Also, the Open Data Institute in London is working with small SMEs, upcoming SMEs, to make use of the data. And I guess there will be some information available as well. Because that's part of it that they're trying to figure out where, first of all, happened with organizations ground, but also to see the potential of economic growth and what, if they're being released, if those applications are being released, what is the money that can be made around that? But I would need to go back and look at that.
Okay, I think we, let's get one in and then more.
I'm slightly terrified by the vision of seamless sharing data. And you're talking about how the council shared 17 address databases. It seems to me there are very good reasons why we don't and aren't allowed to share data. And if you recall the period of the protest, maybe you weren't here then, where your inclusion in the database actually had consequences for the local taxpaying people. And millions of people disappeared. So if you start, you suggested that the household address database would be accumulated lots of other databases about the names and addresses of people living there. Well, this raises issues of data protection and privacy. It also raises issues of data corruption, because there are very good reasons why people would conceal who was living in the house, if it was going to go to racing departments or social security departments. So I wonder whether, what were the issues actually that were encountered in delivering this cross-service sharing, and are there not concerns that we need to have about how under what circumstances data is shared?
Again, one of the government reports said there's sort of three aspects. First of all, the open data, and that's non-personal data, factual data. And some of the sharing refers to that, because people haven't shared any of that data in the past. So that's all non-personal data. And I think that could be as freely shared unless there are any licensing or commercial interest issues. Then there's the middle area, which is where data sharing is allowed under certain conditions. What government tries to do is to facilitate more sharing of data under certain conditions. Because in the past, people work too much in silos, and there have recently been cases where children have died because data have not been shared sufficiently between police, health, social care, and so on. So, and then there's the area where data are absolutely protected. Data sensitive cannot be released, and there need to be very, very special mechanisms around releasing. So the data protection act very, very clearly defines what is protected and how everything should be protected. Where government is looking at the moment is sort of this middle area where more can be shared, and more between government departments, and it's more moved towards that data can be shared within an organization for the benefit of the citizen, or for example for fraud. There has been so much fraud happening because people put different applications in. What is happening now that actually local authorities and government departments are permitted to share more information where people make applications for benefits? Suddenly they see a pattern that is very inconsistent. For example, people have, it was just a case I looked at yesterday which was related to social housing. I don't know if I get it talking together again, but it was people claimed that the house was vacant, but through another database they identified that its tenants had actually lived in there. And suddenly by making that linkage, they could see that people actually incorrectly said that the house was vacant. So for those purposes now, government wants to have a much more data sharing. Because it is about how public sector money is being used and how people fraud the benefits as well. So that's an example.
I can hear the hornets buzzing as the questions heat up or something like that. I think Cameron, you wanted to follow
up. It was just a follow up answer very, very, very quickly. When we started to roll out our national address guarantee in Scotland, one of the first clients, as it were, was the police. And they very, very quickly sussed that where local authorities were able to link an address with the person that linked an address, because there were two, you've got a unique citizen number, you've got a unique address, and the two link. And the very, very first question was, can we get access to that so that if we kick the door down, we know who's at behind the door? And the answer to that was, sorry, no, you can't, because that data is protected. And, you know, although there is a link, you can't have it. Now, there was a very, very good business reason for them to have it, and, you know, everybody would say it'd be a good idea that we know who's behind the door. But there were so many levels of data protection in there that they couldn't automatically have it. Now, what society has to do is say, is it a good idea that they have it? But that's a separate discussion, which actually the GI people are not very good at doing. You know what I mean? They are not good at doing, but that's the discussion they have to have with society.
And that discussion, I think we can have. Oh, there's this one there. Discussion will go over to the pub in a minute, but right, last one.
Even the least personal data could still do tremendous harm, subtle harm, completely sort of apersonal. Aggregate data can still do a lot of harm. So who in local authorities decides, and how would they decide on whether to share that data? Is there a particular person who makes the should we share this or not decision? Or is it all based on the law of the land?
No, there is a senior information officer in each local authority has the responsibility to decide under the data protection act. And the information commissioner, if your own information commissioner in Scotland, I'm speaking again for England at the moment, they have published data sharing guidance, very clearly people can follow it very precisely. So this is sort of one area, but it is not on a whim, it has to be on the basis of those guidance. As to aggregated data, again, the Information Commission has published a guide on anonymizing data, and obviously there is a danger if you bring lots of data set together that you can de-anonymize data. It would de-anonymize and identify the person again in the previous application. But at the moment, I don't remember. I need to look it up again. Where the responsibility lies, I think it lies that the responsibility at the end lies with the person who's starting to de-aggregate the data and comes back to identify the person, that they should then not release it and treat it as protected personal data.
I think in the public interest, one last
point. Okay, sure. Just argument. Quick correction. In Scotland, we don't have a separate commissioner for data protection. It's the same commissioner.
Okay, so then that's
close. Right. We had better leave it there. That's a good run and run. Big issues. Thank you very much. Before we say thank you with the road. It's good to see real applications. I can't wait to get hold of the slides, actually, and use some of those figures. I might stick some of those figures in email there. That's for me to worry about. But useful things we can show the real benefit of GI, but good to consider the real applications and the big issues that are much wider than whether we use a shapefile or a geodatabase. This is for me to worry about. So thank you once again. We will move across to the TVET Library Bar. I think Bruce will probably act kindly, if he's willing, as chaperone and shepherd. So if you are lost, follow Bruce, and Bruce will guide you the way to further discussion. So it just remains for me to say thank you once again for a very interesting and relevant and
to
consider.
If anybody has more questions,
So do come on. Thank you very much.